Welcome to Managing Safety, brought to you by the Florida Aviation Network, an effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and a coalition of local, regional, and national aviation organizations and agencies. This talk show addresses strategies for thinking in today's complex aviation world. Now, here's Ron Timmermans, an independent master flight and ground instructor from Orlando, Florida. He's an airline transport pilot with over 7,000 hours of flight time, most of which is in Beechcraft Bonanzas and Barrens.
Hi, I'm Ron Timmermans, one of the many hosts with the Florida Aviation Network. It's a great day to be at Sun and Fun. It's Thursday and another wonderful day at the air show. If you haven't been here yet, I hope you're able to come later in the week, or if you're not able to make it this year, make plans for next year. 2023 Sun and Fun is not that far away, and it's time to start planning for it. So our audiences often includes pilots, and let me ask you a question. Have you ever had an emergency or felt the need to declare an emergency or actually declared an emergency while you're flying along? I guess I've been very fortunate, somewhere north of 8,000 hours, and I've never had to declare an emergency. I've never really had one that I would even today consider emergency. So good luck, fine flying, the good Lord watching over me, whatever the reason is, I've been blessed from that standpoint. But I often wonder, if I did declare an emergency, could I get any help from ATC? Well, if you've had that same question, today is your day for the answer, because we have with us today Mr. Dean Brown. He's a controller from the Indy Center, Indianapolis Center, and he's going to talk to us about how pilots and controllers can interact during an emergency and be mutually mutually helpful to each other. So, Dean, it's so good to have you. Thank you very much for coming back here and interviewing with us again today. Just a couple of months ago, you were with us on a plane time where you went through many of these other things as well, but I'm delighted to have you back here, and welcome to Sun and Fun. It's a great place to be in early April, isn't it?
It's been absolutely great, and thanks for having me back. So
good. A little warmer here and less snow than Indianapolis, is it?
Absolutely. Okay. It's been a late-ending winter.
Has it been tough for you, huh? Yeah. Well, welcome to sunny Florida, sunny, hot, and humid Florida, and today it looks like we're probably going to get some rain this afternoon, but that'll be refreshing. Maybe it'll cool things down a little bit. Well, Dean, you're a pilot, a CFI, as well as a controller for 31 years. Mm-hmm. Wow, what a record. Congratulations, and thank you for all the good that you do and the help that you give to aviators all around the Indy Center and probably other places as well. But your influence, I'm learning, is beyond the Indy Center with your efforts on making controllers able to better understand what they can do to help pilots in an emergency. So one of these is communicating with ATC. Tell us what you found in your research and what you're trying to purport to other controllers and pilots that can make us all safer.
So just a little bit of background about where the research comes from. So you can think of me as something of a low-time instructor. Even though I've been flying for a long time, I'm just not able to get out to the airport every day. But most controllers are not pilots. And that creates a small problem for me being an instructor. My colleagues think I'm going to automatically have the answer for everything because I'm a CFI, and that doesn't mean I have the answer for everything. So when I became a flight instructor, I started doing my own research just to make sure I could help out pilots in an emergency as much as possible, because it was likely I would get asked to help. That kind of blossomed in ways I had not necessarily foreseen. Indy Center asked me a few years ago to put something together for other Indy Center controllers, and then that in turn has now blossomed to a point where I'm doing some national training for controllers about emergencies.
So you're reaching out to controllers beyond Indy Center to help spread the knowledge and spread the experience then.
Right. But the spin-off, without really intending it, is in order to do the best possible training for controllers about emergencies, I've really had to take a good look at what pilots are going through in a variety of emergencies. And so there's an unintended spin-off of stuff to give to pilots, whether they're talking to controllers or not.
So you've got the unique perspective then, not only being a controller and being one successfully for over 30 years, but also a pilot of more than 1,000 hours and an instructor. So you have two great perspectives that you bring to the table here in trying to help with emergencies.
Yeah, so when I talk to controllers, I can tell them with a straight face, I'm also a pilot, so I know something about what I'm speaking about. And when I talk to pilots, I can say with a straight face, I know what some of those weird controller people do.
Yeah, I can
imagine you do. So, for example, on how to communicate with controllers, you know, one thing that a lot of pilots have heard from, say, their flight instructor or from something like AOPA or whatever, is don't be afraid to declare an emergency and don't be afraid to assert your PIC authority if you need that. I can say the same thing, and I do. It maybe carries a little bit more weight because I am a controller.
I see.
So absolutely, if you need to use or assert your PIC authority, and one of the number one requests that I hear from pilots when I go out and talk to them is a lot of pilots say that controllers talk too much and too fast during some emergencies, and I absolutely endorse the idea that if you have a controller who's talking too much or too fast in an emergency, tell us to slow down, to stand by, or if you need to shut up.
Really?
And I will absolutely back the pilots. Absolutely, if you need to.
Okay.
Some controllers are very intuitively trying to help, and they try a little too hard.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they're concerned about, you know, a safe outcome and a conclusion to whatever the emergency is, and they want to be as helpful as they can. So their motives are good, but sometimes it would be overwhelming for the pilot enduring the actual emergency, and I can see where you can say that. So if you have an emergency and you're getting help from ATC and it's maybe more than you can handle or process right then, you can ask them to slow down or stop talking or whatever, or I'll get back to you. Stand by is another good thing to do with them if you need to. So, Dean, I'm sure that in your 30-some years working with the center, you've had emergencies on the floor. How frequent are emergencies, big or small? I mean, is it one or two a week or one or two a month? Or
There's quite a number. It's going to vary based on the facility. For any even medium-sized tower, let's say that handles some airline traffic, they probably work on average one emergency every other day.
Every other day?
Yeah. So something like Orlando, it wouldn't surprise me if that's kind of the rate at which they deal with that. Having said that, a lot of those are air carriers with passenger medical emergencies.
Certainly, that's understandable.
And that's something of a bread and butter among emergencies. But I do think it's instructive for GA pilots because the air carrier pilots, among other things that lead to the air carrier a very good safety record, is when they have problems with the airplane, they are not hesitant about declaring an emergency if they need to. Now, just because it's an emergency doesn't mean they need to go straight to the airport necessarily, but they do need some special attention, some priority handling. And GA pilots, a lot of times, are a bit more reluctant.
Why do you suppose that is, Dean? I've talked with a lot of pilots and instructed a lot of them, and I've asked them, have you ever declared an emergency? Many of them will say no, or they'll describing something to me that I'm going, my goodness, how horrible is that? And I'll say, did you declare an emergency? No, I didn't want to declare an emergency. What's our reluctance to declare an emergency as a pilot?
I think part of it is a reluctance to maybe worry about having to deal with paperwork. Some of it, I think, is ego.
Ego? Among pilots, really?
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
Of course there is, right?
Yeah.
But at this point, I'd almost make something of a personal appeal. I get if you are surprised with something that's come up extremely suddenly, that, you know, that's the point at which maybe you're going to declare an emergency.
Uh-huh.
There's also a number of cases where somebody is getting into worsening weather, and they eventually, a few minutes later, get into some kind of VFR and IMC, maybe a scud running situation, or somebody's stuck on top of an overcast layers of clouds, and they circle and circle and circle. In that case, when they call us, one of the first questions I'm going to ask is something like, how much fuel do you have left? I would much prefer they say something like 2 or 3 hours because they called us early, because now we have options. If I say, how much fuel do you have on board, and their answer is something like, I'd rather not say, that drives a very different set of strategies.
Yes.
But the sooner you can call in some kind of situation like that, or if you have a rough-running engine, remember, most controllers are not pilots. And when you call us with an emergency, very often we're already busy with a lot of our normal stuff. And I think pilots appreciate we can be pretty busy at times. An emergency does not stop all that other stuff from happening. Our workload can spike through the roof.
Yeah.
So if you give us a call when you know that some problem is developing, that makes it much easier on our end to provide effective help.
I'm sure. So, Dean, if during the day and during your shift, one of the controllers is working a GA pilot and he or she declares an emergency and they recognize they need some help, then they're not a pilot and they recognize they need some help, do they come and find Dean Brown, and have you help with that, or do they transfer the pilot to your frequency, or what happens?
There's a lot of different situations, but in many cases what they'll do is the very first thing is they'll tell the supervisor in the area at the center or comparable in a tower or TRACON, and then that supervisor will get the best available help. The center, you know, we might have 100 controllers on duty at a given time in several different areas, and it's tough to keep track of who's plugged in, who's maybe on break or in a class, and who's doing what. So for the supervisors at a center, I advocate that they just make a page throughout the whole building for any pilot-rated controllers to come down to whatever area it is that have the problem. So even if you think that I'm somehow like the best expert at Indy Center, I might be plugged in working a busy session. I can't just unplug and walk away.
Right.
So sometimes you'll get one of my other pilot-rated colleagues who are very good, and they might be the one helping.
So that's great. That's great. Do you ever resort to outside help outside of the center via telephone interface or not?
If we need to, that's pretty rare.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare.
Kind of unusual. Ever have any emergencies involving a passenger who has to take over for an incapacitated pilot, or is that really rare?
That does happen. And on that one, one of the surprising things that I had not expected when I started doing the research, we tend to think of that as something like the pilot's had a heart attack and now the passenger has to fly, and it's in all the good movies, right?
Yeah.
Actually, a significant fraction of those is carbon monoxide poisoning. And the pilot happens to be the one who sort of conks out first. So if we get a pilot incapacitation event in a GA airplane, especially if it's something like winter, so there's a good chance they're running the cabin heat, we want to assess, A, you know, is this passenger, are they flying the plane, or is the autopilot, is the airplane stable, and how are you feeling? We realize you're maybe going to be a little stressed, but if we sense there's any carbon monoxide poisoning, again, we're going to pursue a particular strategy to deal with that.
And is all this part of your instruction to the controllers in how to handle an emergency and the like? Do you brief them on that?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's part of your education system.
Yeah.
So you were telling me that the education, or are you calling this program by a specific name, or?
So the project I'm working on has some different components.
Okay.
One of which is a formal program that we have, which is semi-annual recurrent training that all controllers go through.
Oh, okay, semi-annual.
It's very professionally done. It's run out of FAA headquarters. And that training has different modules. And the last couple of rounds, we have included stuff about emergencies. I've been able to write a lot of the content and outlines for
those. So this is not just Indy Center controllers. This is all controllers now that are getting these modules in their recurrent training semi-annually.
To some extent, I'm looking to expand it because as good as it is right now, it's been pretty limited so far.
I see. So. Okay. Well, that's great. That's great. Well, another of the emergencies I think that many pilots are quite fearful of would be right after takeoff, the proverbial engine sputtering and stopping. There's almost no time to react. How, if at all, can we interact with a tower controller if we're at a towered airport and get their help?
So assuming it's a towered airport, for that kind of situation, it really is so time critical and you have to assert your PIC authority. By all means, if you're going to turn back, and there's a whole discussion about whether to make the impossible turn.
That is a discussion.
If you turn back, please tell us immediately that you are turning back. The controller may or may not clear you to land any runway. Even if they don't, you still have the right to exercise your PIC authority. If there's other traffic, the controller is going to be stopping somebody who's on the takeoff roll, telling somebody on final to go around. But in the impossible turn, when people do turn back, the biggest actual safety threat is probably stall spin.
Indeed.
There's a case to be made for the controller, in addition to saying something like clear to land any runway, perhaps saying something like do not stall the airplane. Now, it might be better for the controller to shut up. There's a bit of a debate about that. But if the controller is going to say something else, I want it to be just that. That is not the place to get fuel on board in time remaining, the number of people on board in that, because right now the pilot needs to make their undivided attention on doing the Bob Hoover thing and flying it all the way to wherever they're going to end up.
Yes, indeed. So a couple of times you've mentioned PIC authority. So I believe I know what that means, but for our audience who may not be completely familiar with that, what specifically are you talking about PIC authority?
So officially, Part 91 Flight Rules, or officially, Title 14 of Code of Federal Regulations 91.3, pilot in command is responsible for and is the final authority about the safety of flight, and in an emergency, they can bend any of the normal flight rules. 91.123 is a similar one about bending whatever air traffic clearances we've been giving you. Controllers have an analogous thing. The mouthful reference is the 7110.65 2-1-1D3. Don't worry about memorizing that.
Yeah, I was really wondering about
quiz,
that.
But that's the analogous authority for controllers. We have our normal set of rules to follow, but in an emergency, we can kind of bend those normal rules as needed to the extent needed to meet the emergency.
Maybe an outrageous example that a pilot experiences emergency and they're headed towards a restricted airspace.
Mm-hmm.
And their best or only option that they feel is viable is to penetrate that restricted airspace, even though they haven't yet received a clearance. They can do that under their emergency authority. They may have to explain sometime later what they did and why, but they do have the authority to do that. If that is the safest way to deal with the emergency at that time, that's what a pilot should do, right? I mean, that's kind of a
almost,
rare example.
Almost always.
Yeah, okay.
There's always an exception
I'm sure.
Somewhere. If you depart Reagan National northbound and have an engine failure, I would not turn over the White House and Capitol on the way back.
That would not be good.
Apart from that and a couple others like that, basically use your PIC authority. You know, if you take off from Orlando Executive, okay, and you have an engine failure and you think you're just going to go head on into all the departing traffic out of Orlando International, you might want to use some common sense and rethink.
Indeed.
But apart from some rare exceptions like that, pretty much anything you can reasonably justify an emergency, if you need to do it, by all means do it.
Okay, very good. So I didn't want to encourage you to do anything outside the regulations as pilots, but certainly if to maintain the safety of your particular flight, you have to do something that is unusual and would be otherwise be outside of the rules of the flight, then you need to do that to make sure you conclude that particular flight safely. Well, thanks for explaining that. How about pilots that flying along on a VFR day and the weather gets progressively worse and worse, and they eventually visibility goes down, the clouds get down, we're down to scud running and trying to make sure that we stay out of IMC, but all of a sudden we run into IMC. Is that a problem, and how do controllers help us with that?
Okay, so number one, in most VFR and IMC situations, generally speaking, if you keep the wings level or only a small bank, you'll be fine. I don't want to give the impression that guarantees that takes
right.
care of everything else, but if you work through all the details, in almost all cases, if you just keep the wings level, you'll turn out okay. Having said that, for me, I see kind of two big things. One is I have what I consider a different family of IFR or VFR and IMC situations. So one is somebody who's stuck on top of an overcast layer. They're VMC right now. They're worried about how to get down. And there's a particular set of preferred strategies, again, depending on how much fuel they have at the time. There's somebody who's in IMC. They have the immediate threat. There's kind of a scud running situation where somebody's down low, flirting with cell towers and hills and things like that. And in those cases, many times the preferred strategy, not always, but many times the preferred strategy is just a wings level climb. And granted, you're up in the clouds, but now we only have the one threat to deal with rather than that threat plus all the cell towers and the like.
Yeah.
There's a couple other situations in part of that family. And then what I'm trying to build out for controllers is what I loosely call a toolkit of different things we can do. And then use an understanding of which situation the pilot's in, select the appropriate tools from the toolkit, and use that to help out. So, for example, one of the tools I have in the toolkit is what I call the emergency instrument letdown procedure. And I don't mean letting the pilot down like they're disappointed. I mean letting somebody down safely through the clouds to an area where it's VFR underneath. And if you'll permit me a war story real quick.
I will.
I'm going to talk about two friends of mine, and they really were friends. This isn't me in disguise. This was a glider pilot behind a tow plane on a cross-country tow for a particular reason. Marginal VFR, the weather got worse and worse. The pilot in the tow plane was instrument rated. The plane was capable, so he called approach and said, "Hey, approach, this is so-and-so, can I pick up a clearance?" Approach said, "Okay." They gave him a clearance and everything. And it just got worse and worse. The guy in the glider, he's got no instruments, no radio. Okay, I mean, instruments, he's got altimeter, airspeed, magnetic compass, and basically a VSI. And he got to
and
the
point. And a tow line out in front of him.
And a tow line out in front. The tow plane disappeared, and for a while he just kind of followed the tow line, and in theory it was hooked up to something, right? And then he cut to where he couldn't do that. So he released. He then did the absolute smartest thing, because VFR and IMC in a glider with no instruments is very deadly. He did the smartest thing he could have done in that particular glider. he went stick full back and full left rudder. So what's that going to do? Puts him into a spin.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Now, most pilots cringe at the idea of doing a spin anyway, let alone when you're VFR and IMC. But in that particular glider, it's a known flight situation. He spun, popped out the bottom of the clouds, recovered VFR. He did have to make an off-airport landing, which in a glider is doable, right?
Yeah.
Meantime, the pilot of the tow plane called approach, and he said, hey, can you mark my position? And the controller said, how come? He says, well, the glider I'm towing just released, and the controller really didn't know what to do with that one.
Yeah,
but
I can imagine
it opened my eyes in a way to the idea that that's an extreme example. But if you get into a controlled situation, let down through the clouds, if there's VFR underneath, you can do that. So the letdown procedure is a far more benign way to get somebody who's stuck on top, especially, bring the speed back, gear down. I would leave the flaps up, keep the wings level, bring the power back. They descend down through the clouds with the wings level, pop out underneath, have a good day.
Land successfully.
And land successfully.
Wonderful. I'm sure you and other controllers throughout the United States have had similar emergencies and maybe even more stringent emergencies than that, and have worked tirelessly to help pilots end up with a safe landing after a pretty significant emergency. Dean, that pretty much wraps it up for time today, but my goodness, we could talk on and on about your special project and what you're doing to make flying safer and helping pilots and controllers understand here's what you can and should do in an emergency, and a toolbox of things for controllers to do to make their services even more valuable for the pilots that they serve. Thank you for your service to our country and the FAA and to all pilots around. We appreciate what you and all the many controllers do. Thank you for joining us today. It's good to have
you. Thank you, Ron.
All right, we hope to have you back again. So I'm Ron Timmermans, one of the many hosts with the Florida Aviation Network, bringing you another interview live and in person, or live and in the clear, from the Sun and Fun campus at Lakeland, Florida. Please join us for the next interview. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed today's Managing Safety, brought to you by the Florida Aviation Network, an effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and a coalition of local, regional, and national aviation organizations and agencies. Please visit our studio website to hear past programs.